Start now by talking about the Astros 2010 draft class, which, because of the Jose Valverde signing in Detroit, gave the Astros 3 first-round picks, including a supplemental round pick in Mike Wasnicka, and a lot of other really interesting prospects. Now, we actually have Mike Foltynewicz, the pitcher we got at number 19, ranked higher than Delino DeShields Jr., who was picked number 8. Somebody want to take that? Who ranked one higher than the other?
I've got him ranked that's actually the same, so I see that Brooks, you did.
Yeah, I have him a little bit higher. DDJ really has the high ceiling and everything, but I have Folty higher because I think Folty has a higher floor. Because Folty already has, you know, the good fastball. He has potential with both his curveball, slider, and a changeup. But, you know, all 4 pitches really puts him into the category that can be considered for an ace pitcher. I see him more. Yeah, he does have the upside of a 1, but more likely scenario is a number 2, in my opinion. But I have Folty higher than DDJ, mostly because there's a whole lot that has to happen for DDJ to really reach his potential. I see him as an everyday second baseman, as a floor, but I just see a whole lot has to happen before he reaches that.
Well, I think this gets into something that has to do with evaluating pitchers versus evaluating position player prospects, especially in high school. You can scout pitchers and you can really quantify certain things about them. He gets this much break on his pitches. He throws this hard. You know, he has this many pitches that he throws. And, you know, it's much more quantifiable in a way than when you look at a position player and you have to judge their swing path. You have to judge their bat speed. And most importantly, their pitch recognition. So it's a lot easier to say Folty has a higher floor because, you know, guys with his stuff, they're going to strike out some batters, you know, they're going to get some ground balls because he has so much movement on his fastball, and that ended up being exactly the case, and we saw in his rookie ball performance. So,
well, and like you were saying, I think there is a difference between starting pitching prospects and position players, because Folty, for me, has a lot more projectability than some other guys because he's big. Like, he's just a big body. You can see that body filling out. You can see his fastball velocity growing. You can see him being a 200 innings guy at some point because of his frame. And, you know, as far as I don't really care how tall a pitcher is usually, but I know that big guys can be more workhorse types. So if we drafted him, that's great, and I like that. And I think his upside is a little bit better than DeShields, who I really like. I mean, I've talked about it on TCB before. I think he does have really good power potential that people are kind of downplaying because his forearms just look so strong that I think he can really turn on pitches down the road. But obviously we don't know anything about how he's done this year because it's such a small sample size.
Yeah, and that's the crazy thing about Folty is that we talk about him having so much projection, and he really does, is that it's crazy that we can project him, and we can project him to gain velocity because he already throws, probably sits, and averages around 93 and 94 miles an hour, which would be one of the hardest throwing starting pitchers in Major League Baseball, if he were in baseball, right, Major League Baseball right now. If he's going to gain 2 miles an hour on his fastball, that's ridiculous.
Well, and he's got that thing that scouts really like, too, that downward plane. Being a big guy, he can really get on top of the ball and get some good sink on his four-seam fastball when he's throwing it, which can be pretty dangerous for strikeouts and ground balls.
for me, as far as a high school pitching prospect, he is almost perfect. The only knock against him right now is his command, and because of his clean, repeatable delivery, I think that's going to be fine too.
What do you guys think about, I've read a couple comparisons, and in the video that I saw of him when he was in the bullpen for the Astros, I think before a game or something with Brad Ahrensberg looking on, they said a lot, his mechanics kind of look like Tim Lincecum's, and from the picture you can kind of see a little bit of that in his delivery.
He gets a lot of, looks like he does get a lot of torque on his delivery, which is the same thing that Lincecum does, but it actually looks cleaner to me than Lincecum, which, I actually think Lincecum has really good mechanics, but it definitely causes quite a bit of arm speed and everything.
Well, and the funny thing about pitching mechanics, talking about prospects, is two guys that came into the draft with a consensus of no real problems were Strasburg and Mark Pryor, and those both turned horribly, horribly wrong quickly. Whereas, Lincecum, everybody was reluctant about him heading into that draft, and the Giants took a flyer on him, and he's been great. So, I think as long as it's repeatable and it's low effort, any crazy delivery is fine,
That's mainly what I look for, is I don't want it to look, violent is the best word.
Well, for me, I hate the inverted, just because I do have, I've had a lot of anatomy classes, a lot of exercise physiology, and so I see so much more stress put on the elbow and the shoulder because of the inverted W. I'm not saying that that is a, the sign to look for when looking at mechanics, but I'm just saying that, it is a red flag. It's something to consider. It does increase the chance. It doesn't make it a surefire definite that pitcher is going to have an injury, but it does increase the chance. The thing to think about with Lincecum and how he didn't turn into an injury-prone pitcher is because he is a freak athlete and that he's able to time his body movements together so well. And that's what minimizes his injuries, is because everything flows together so well. And so it doesn't put that added strain, the parts moving in opposite directions.
I've heard,
that causes a lot of strains. Do what?
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask you about, is I've heard that what it is when you get the force of the pitching motion not going smoothly, through the arm and all going toward propelling the ball toward the plate, but instead it's kind of jerking body parts against each other.
Yeah, and that's the thing with the inverted W. As you can watch a pitcher, you can see his front leg is going forward. At the same time, his back elbow is going completely the opposite direction and going backwards. And then the thing that really, really sets the inverted W away from everything else is the timing issue. And that his arm going forward then has so much more area to cover and distance to cover to get to that same point that the normal pitcher would have to get to the correct motion of going forward when that front plant foot lands and the rest of the body starts going forward. And so that added distance puts the strain on those tendons and those ligaments, and that's what causes injury.
Well, I think going back to, I know one of our commenters posted Bags, who posted on the pitching mechanics, which I thought was really interesting, and talked a little bit more about Parker pitching mechanics and the inverted W. And then also Al Leiter did a diamond demo on MLB Network that I happened to catch, which also talked about the inverted W. We actually compared him, and he was comparing Steven Strasburg's mechanics, which uses the inverted W, to both Mark Pryor and John Smoltz. And, obviously you have on this, you have a pitcher on one side of each spectrum where Mark Pryor kind of burnt out early in his career and John Smoltz kind of lasted a little bit longer but did have some arm issues later on in his career. So I think that's kind of telling. And then, you know, in that same post, Max talked about Bud Norris's mechanics, which does use the inverted W. I think kind of is telling as to why a lot of us end up in the bullpen.
Yeah, and you know, I think as Brooks said, it was a good point. The inverted W, the inverted L, they don't guarantee injuries. Will Carroll tweeted pictures of Bob Feller and Nolan Ryan the other day, and they both had mechanics that we would now think were, you know, really warning signs, and they both pitched forever. So it's really about maintaining the chance of injury, you know, limiting your chance, I guess, is what I was trying to say. And that's something that I think Folty does is, you know, we've limited the chance that he will get injured over the next couple of years.
Right. And just to be clear, he doesn't have that
right.
inverted W.
Right.
He has a very, it looks like he's playing catch at 93 miles an hour.
Yeah. Which is what we all look like when we play catch, I'm sure.
I think I throw like 40 miles per hour.
Okay, so let's touch a little more on DDJ. Have we really seen enough from him to develop anything more than the scouting videos and the stuff we know heading into the draft?
What I see about his power and the reason why people doubt his power has nothing to do with his strength. It has to do with his swing path. His swing path is very level. It looks like Michael Warren's to me, anyway. Obviously from the opposite side of the plate, but... I think scouts are wondering whether he's going to get enough off. That's kind of my concern also. Of course, they may retool his swing, so you never know.
Well, from what I've read is that a lot of the when he's playing high school is that he would start getting pitched around. So I think that may have had an effect on how the scouts viewed him and you know, the evaluation of him is that a lot of people would pitch around him because he was so good at hitting the baseball.
I mean, like Christian was saying, is he doesn't have a whole lot of lift and loft in his swing. But, I mean, with as much as the front office was saying after he was drafted, now he has that power potential, I'm pretty confident that, you know, they will try to tool his swing to add a little more loft so that he does add that power because, like you said, David, he has those ridiculous forearms that really say that he can add a lot of power to his swing.
Well, and even if we're talking about, you know, Craig Biggio type numbers as far as, you know, 40 or 50 doubles a year, and, you know, if the home run power never develops because of his swing path, that's still really significant. And I think, you know, when we're talking about power potential, a lot of times we get caught up in home run numbers. But a guy that can hit, like Jason Wirth this year, is, I think, got 40-something doubles. And he's definitely considered a power hitter. He's not Ryan Howard, but he's a lot better than Jeff Kepinger in how he's perceived in his power level this year.
And the thing about a guy like Glenn at the Fields, as compared to Jeff Kepinger, is that Kepinger is slow.
Yeah.
Glenn at the Fields is going to get a lot of doubles just from his legs.
Yeah, and that's something that I know the Tri-City Valley Cats guys talked about on a recent post on Cats Corner is that they call it said Austin Waits walked his way to a double because, you know, he took a walk and then stole second base, and that's just as good as hitting a double to the wall.
Right.
And it's something that Kepinger cannot do. And
the big question for me with Lyle DeShields is how much he's going to walk. His scouts think he's going to hit, and I believe him. Obviously, he's fast. He has the strength if he can exploit it to hit for some power along with his legs, but we just don't really know anything with a lot of these high school hitters about how much patience they have. And I'm hoping that some of their stuff in the past, you know, Giovanni Meyer takes his walks, Jason Castro takes his walks, Wasnicka is a guy who walks. I hope that means they're looking at that and that they like guys with a patient approach because I just have no idea personally how patient this field is.
And I think that's a valid question. I don't feel as I don't really have as much of a question about that for two reasons. One, like we said before, he was pitched around basically from his junior year. In high school, his sophomore year, he had this breakout season, and basically everybody in his district started pitching around him for the next 2 years. So he's already had to see, you know, junk balls and stuff like that and learn to differentiate between it to still have success. He's also got a dad who was a pretty good major leaguer, and I think that goes a long way to helping a guy understand the game. And you know, I think that's one of the things we talk about on pitch recognition is just knowing the game. You know, knowing situations, watching the game, watching pitchers, knowing, you know, what kind of pitch is going to be coming at you, what it looks like, and where should you swing. And I think
really
he's
definitely... not so much bloodlines as having the best teacher.
Right, yeah, yeah, for sure. So, but it sounds like Delino DeShields Sr. has been a big part of his son's development, and hopefully that'll help him down the road. So why don't we move on to another guy from the draft, the second round pick, Vincent Velasquez, who we have at number 7 overall. Tim,
I actually liked him better than Folti, but that's purely based on what they've done so far in the minor leagues.
Well, would you talk a little bit about your how you assess guys on performance rather than projectability?
Well, I kind of look at what they've accomplished so far. Velasquez and I think Folti both got into the system pretty early, so we were able to get certainly something I felt comfortable breaking them on. And I mean, they're not really that split, that far split. I ranked Folti as a B minus prospect, and I gave Velasquez a B ranking. I just simply liked what I liked about Velasquez a lot better. Although I still like Folti.
Well, like with Velasquez, he has better numbers. He struck better at a higher rate. He walked at a lower rate. Didn't have the phenomenal ground ball rate, and he had less. He pitched about 15 innings less than Folti. But the thing that impresses me most about Velasquez is how raw of a pitcher he really is. We're talking about a guy who was recruited as a shortstop up until this year. He made his college commitment as a shortstop. And then this year in high school, he decided to start pitching some. And that's what really impressed the scouts. This guy doesn't have the greatest pitchability at this point because he hasn't been pitching for even a full season. So with as raw as he is and the fact that he's already thrown the low 90s, gives me a whole lot of promise. I definitely am more impressed with him than I was about Tanner Bujou coming out of high school, or a guy like Alowitz. He's so raw, but he has so much potential. So I really, really like Velasquez personally.
He could be the next Jordan Lyles, maybe even more than Folti, who's like a super high upside guy, but maybe doesn't have as much command. But it feels like so far, from the numbers at least, that Velasquez has really good command, especially for how raw he is.
Well, I think you can tell that. I looked a lot more at the traditional type of stats, you know, whip, strikeouts, first base on balls. And, you know, Velasquez is way ahead of Folti in that aspect. You know, in the minor leagues, it's this is all small sample size, but Velasquez is able to keep his whip under 1, which I think is amazing. And he's got a strikeout to base on balls ratio of 5, whereas Folti has a whip about 1.366, and his strikeout to base on balls is 2.60. So, you know, I'm I kind of fell in love with Bull in Trinidad, although he's probably not going to get a call to major leagues, but I kind of like those control guys who can keep down the strikeout first base on ball numbers, as opposed to those guys who can strike out a lot, but they also walk off at the same time. I like those control guys, kind of the Greg Maddux almost type of pitchers where, you know, they're not going to strike out a whole bunch of people, but they're also not going to walk a whole bunch of people. I think keeping people off the base paths is something important for this team.
And, I mean, that's definitely understandable because I know whip is a very similar stat to something like H per nine, which is hits per nine innings, which I know John Sickles, he still uses on occasion or pretty regularly when he's evaluating pitchers. The fact that he does limit his base runners is very important. That's something that a pitcher really has to do, and for someone to keep it under one is still something that's, you know, you don't see all the time. And that goes back to just he's able to do that with how raw he is. And, you know, right now he's not striking out a whole ton of people like a lot of the real big-name pitchers, but because he already has a low 90s fastball and he's 18 years old, really, and so he's likely to add a few ticks just like Fulte is, maybe not as much because he's not quite as projectable as Fulte, but the fact that he's pitching, he's drafted as a pitcher, and tells me, you know, he's got potential on his breaking stuff as well as his fastball, and he's probably a guy who, you know, who will strike a lot of guys out eventually, just not quite yet.
Well, and I think, you know, like you say, keeping people off the base paths is good. You know, in retrospect to the major leagues, a 1.2 whip, even though it's outdated a little bit, a 1.2 whip is still a pretty good pitcher. So to keep it under one, especially in the minor leagues, is very good. You know, I'm a little bit concerned that Fulte had one over 1.2 in just the minor leagues. Obviously, I think that can improve considering he's still 18-year-olds, which is why I still kind of was able to look over that and give him a fairly high grade. But I just think at this point, Velasquez just looks so much better.
Yeah, I mean, he's obviously performed better. Obviously, a lot of Fulte's grade is in time to projection because he just has higher upside, obviously. And that's what it looks like to me. And, you know, in the sample size, you can't draw definitive conclusions anyway. But it looks like Velasquez probably has better command right now than Fulte does. But you never know with these teenagers how that's going to develop. One thing that concerns me about Velasquez, though, is his injury history. And I'm a little bit worried because we've already seen a little of that this year. And I think I remember hearing he had a little bit of that before the draft, too, with arm issues. And that can be a big problem for some pitchers. We'll just have to see how that develops.
Certainly, he enjoyed playing shortstop and did a lot of that, and he didn't, like, entirely focus on pitching. I certainly can see that being a big concern for him. So, you know, it'd be interesting how the Astros bring him along and how he performs next year.
Well, and going back real quick to the talking about hits per nine inning and whip, I think the component to whip that you should be more concerned about in the minor leagues is walks. Because, you know, hits per nine innings, it's like a sliding scale. The more hits they give up, the less, like, there's a point where you're not as worried if the rest of their stats are good. If they're not walking people and they're striking a bunch of people out, but they're still giving up, you know, more hits than you'd like, it may be because the infield defense is not very good, or the left fielder is really a first baseman and they're just playing him out there because they want to see what they can do. So, you know, there's a little bit of that, I think, in some stats, which makes Velasquez more impressive because he does have the numbers he does. But, you know, like I say, that's just the tough thing about using statistics in the minor leagues is you don't know the quality of the defense a lot of times.
Well, and that's why I use the strikeout to base on balls right. ratio as well as the whip. I try not to focus on just one statistic. I look at the ERA right. and then look at the whip and then, you know, look at the strikeout per nine and base on balls per nine and then, you know, the strikeout versus base on balls ratio and try to, you know, kind of get a gauge on it all and kind of combine them all and see how I feel about it.
Yeah.
And even you can even see the ground outs error. You have to look a little bit on the minor league website. They have that too, so you can kind of get a feel for how many ground balls they get as well, which is important.
Which I used to care more about that, but I've sort of gotten a little bit jaded about it because you're not really getting a good picture of how many ground balls and how many fly balls they give up. Because a guy could have a lot of outs, but also give up a lot of fly ball hits. And so that's something, you know, when I've done, like, pitcher profiles and tracked their starts, I go through the box scores and manually calculate ground balls, fly balls, you know, hits, outs, whatever. So, you know, like I say, minor league stats are just problematic a lot of times. And for people like us who obviously enjoy using stats to analyze, especially minor leaguers, you know, there are some hurdles that you have to cover.
And, I mean, that's the big knock on, like, websites like with, like, minorleaguesplits.com. You know, they give you line drive rate, they give you fly ball rate, and they give you ground ball rate. But the thing is that's all determined by the official score.
Mm-hmm.
And who is he to say what's really technically a line drive or, you know, just maybe a short or long fly ball or something like that.
Right.
It's very, very, there's a lot of leeway either way. But I mean, you got to do with what you got to do. You have so much that you can use, and you have to base, you know, some conclusions based off of it. And that's why you have to use so many statistics in order to really judge what you think about a pitcher instead of using just like maybe one or two.
Right.
And the more the sample size, the better. And another thing, it's kind of a little bit of a tangent, but these scorekeepers, and I don't want to knock on them, but minor league scorekeepers, there's not going to be the same standard that they're held to in the major leagues necessarily. And this has to do with things like the error statistic, and I always see people saying, oh, but he can't be a good defensive shortstop because he has, you know, 40 errors or whatever. But beyond other things, like their coaches are pushing them to actually push their boundaries and go after balls and try to make plays on balls they wouldn't necessarily normally do in the majors, or the fields aren't maintained all that well. There's also the scorekeeper who may not be as consistent in judging what's an error and what's not as a major league scorekeeper. So that's why you don't want to judge some of these statistics very well in terms of saying a guy's not a good defender because of that.
Well, and I do think we all do an excellent job of doing that in our analysis. I'm not saying, you know, definitely the three of you that are keyed in and do that when you're talking about prospects. But it's something to consider, you know, when we're talking about these guys, is there is that difference. I know that, I think it was the Hardball Times published a study of looking at minor league ballparks and the percentage of line drives and fly balls and things like that, and the difference between parks varied wildly. And that's a little, you know, that gets to the inconsistency of the scores. And that's why a lot of times minor league stats aren't the greatest measure of a player. You have to kind of put it in context, like Brooks was trying to say. I'll also say that, you know, I cover a collegiate league summer team here in Bryan College Station, and they play on a nice field, but it was a former little league park for, like, you know, the 16, 17-year-old boys. And the infield, and multiple times I talked to players after the game, and they said, yeah, we had a good defensive night in spite of the infield. And you'd see balls coming at a guy, you know, the second baseman is set up where he should be, and the ball's coming straight at him, and it goes off the grass onto the dirt and takes, you know, just a giant hop in another direction, and, you know, it falls for a base hit, and he's got to scramble over to it. So, you know, obviously the Texas Collegiate League is not the Texas League or the Sally League or anything like that. But I do think there's some variation in how people maintain their fields in the minors.
Oh, you hear about all the time in the NFL that different teams maintain their fields to a different level of quality.
Which team was recently that they almost had a game canceled because the the field was in so bad repair. Okay, it was a major league mm-hmm. team. It was the Marlins, or
yeah, I think so. Well,
it makes sense.
The urban legend is that the Packers had heaters under the field, and they would turn them on when Green Bay was on that side of the field, and turn it off when the other team was on that side of the field.
But oh, well, they got the same thing for the Minnesota Vikings. Yeah. The metronome, they'll turn the air conditioning on. The other team's taking a field goal.
Right, right. So, I mean, I think there's always going to be variations in the fields, but I think there's a wider gap in the minors as far as field conditions go.
Well, and that's right. Why I stay away from BAP in the minor leagues, is because of the different competition level and because of the different ballparks and stuff like that. BAP is pretty much useless in the minor leagues.
Yeah.
Well, I think you have to put it on a totally different scale. I wouldn't say it's 100% useless, but you got to remember how bad the defenses are, the fields are different, all those different things. Like, so we'll take a guy like J.D. Martinez. He has a really high, batting average on balls in play, is what we're talking about. He's not going to have, I forget what it is, like 400 batting average on balls in play in the majors. But he might always be a high batting average on balls in play guy because he gets a lot of line drives. So,
well, Bert Wallace was the same way. He had like a 398 batting average on balls in play in low A. I mean, that came down as he went up, but he did have a ridiculously high batting average on balls in play. I mean, and the theory kind of is that some people would create their own luck, which is what BAP is, because they're such a good hitter. On the opposite end, Pedro Feliz only had a batting average of balls in play on .276, which, especially from this last season, you kind of see that he wasn't the greatest hitter. So, you can take, like I said, the percentages of ground balls, line drives, and everything in there. But I think that's why it's, and I kind of shy away from using BAP in the minors, is because there's no set standard of how people are playing as far as the competition level. You're going to have good years and bad years as far as competition level, and you're going to be facing different competition at every level. So,
and that is true, but. Is the way I look at it is you have to adjust it almost mentally for each level. Like, I think, like, batting average of ball in play drops about 30 to 50 points or something like that from AAA to the majors on average. And so while a guy like J.D. Martinez hits for over 400 batting average of ball in play right now, yeah, he's in all likelihood, he's likely a little bit lucky. But to say that he's going to hit that at the majors, of course not. But, it's kind of have to be adjusted at the level. 400 at low A is probably not too ridiculous. It should probably be around 350. Or maybe even as high as 375. You just kind of have to adjust it for that level. That level is, you're going to have a higher batting average of ball in play at the low A than you are going to have at double A.
Because the defenders are better is the main reason.
Yeah.
Right.
And so in that regard, it is useful to an extent. But, I mean, yeah, you have to adjust it mentally, kind of. There's not a set standard to adjust it for. You just kind of have to consider the player and consider the level to really realize just how lucky or unlucky.
Okay, I know Tim was just talking about Brett Wallace, which is one of his man crushes. I'm not going to go back and double-check his statistics on him to see if he's inflating him. But let's move on to another one of his man crushes in Ben Heath, the power-hitting catcher from Penn State.
Oh, yeah, I love this guy. I mean, if he's putting up the kind of power numbers that he's put up already, for being a catcher, me, Christian, and Brooks actually had kind of a bit of a Twitter conversation regarding that and Castro and Q. But if he's going to produce those kind of numbers, I don't want to say it's going to be Mike Piazza level, but to produce maybe a level or two lower than that would be very good for a catcher position. And then you have some kind of, I think we all came to consensus that you have some kind of backup catcher that is very good defensively, like a Castro or Q. I actually like the Castro-Heath combination. You know, you can kind of play the matchups because Heath is a right-handed batter and Castro is a left-handed batter who does seem to take his walks while Heath will provide the power and, you know, driving some runs, although you do kind of give up a little bit defensively with them. But as we've seen from Brad Mills, he kind of likes to play that matchup.
And, you know, the more I've thought about it is at first I was saying we trade him, and I still think that, or trade one of them, rather. I still think that would be a viable option, but as I thought about Brad Mills, like you were saying, he likes to use his bench players, and I'm concerned that if we have Roberto Quintero, in the long term, he's always going to get half of the playing time, just because that's how Brad Mills works. So if we have to give it half and half, I would rather have two good hitting catchers.
Yeah, and I mean, you're going to have with Q, I mean, he's great defensively. He's going to pick off some people and get some base stealers. But in all honesty, Castro almost does the same thing. Maybe the only difference is that Q is going to block balls better in the dirt at this point. Castro seems to be struggling with that a little bit lately. But if Brad Mills is going to split them when they do, you know, I'd rather have hitters that are going to hit above 250, which Q, at his best, is going to hit 250. Probably about average, he's going to hit between 220 and 240.
Oh, go ahead.
I didn't really I left the splits either. But yeah, you're right. That if Mills is going to do it that way, that's definitely a really good option. Personally, I'd rather have, you know, in long term, I'd rather have Castro getting, you know, a bigger blunt of the starts and having, you know, the typical backup catcher that's, you know, defensive first, a guy like Q. But with the type of manager we have where Mills plays to those type of splits a lot, you know, if that's really what his philosophy is, keeping Heath is definitely probably in the long term a whole lot better, just because he really is young. He's going to be, you know, controllable for a lot of years. He's going to be cheap, and he's going to hit for a whole lot of power. Pulling to the crawfish boxes a whole lot would be outstanding power.
Well, the thing that's in the queue is that I was thinking about is with Castro, he's just started his, you know, arbitrate, you know, he's just started his control with the Astros. If anyone doubts he's going to be with the major league team next year, once Heath comes, you can essentially get rid of Q, and you've got just don't get rid of Q alone. You've got another young player that you have control over for several years to come, and you don't have to pay a big amount of money to.
Before we get too deep into planning out Heath's entire major league career, maybe we should talk a little bit about, you know, his attributes.
I think that's a fair point.
Well, I know that the Tri-City guys talk quite a bit about how his power is legitimate, that he would put on the best show in batting practice as far as hitting home runs and really had the raw power that is encouraging of a guy that's moving up through the system. You know, he's not just a college guy that made his name on aluminum bats. He's got the muscle to hit, you know, 20 or 30 home runs a year.
I actually posted a video of him on site Project Prospect, where they do a lot of in-depth analysis of batting swings, and they were very impressed with his strength. One thing they mentioned was he has a little hitch in his swing where he stops his hands, and that might cause him to take more strikeouts. We've seen that a little bit already in his minor league career. That's the one thing that worries me about him, is how is he going to play with the holes in his swing against more advanced pitching. Right now, I would say his ceiling is something along the lines of a Mike Napoli-type hitter, with really good power, but probably not going to hit for a really high average, although you never know. And obviously not very good defense. But it seems like his power is really legitimate. He has a lot of strength.
Well, and I think his defense could get better. We're talking about a guy that basically only played regularly at catcher his junior season before getting drafted by the Astros. So, and he's young. He's 21 years old, and they thought enough of him to promote him to Lexington this season. So, you know, I do think there's some room for growth there. He seems fairly athletic. The only thing that I kind of worry about is he seems kind of stiff on some of the videos that I saw before the draft. I think that given time to work and, you know, going to the instructional league in the fall, I think he could be a pretty decent catcher.
Yeah, and that's a good point, too. And he's not, in terms of his experience, he's not that far removed from high school, even though he was a junior.
Well, and I don't think in the Astros system, at least, you know, we've had, we got Jason Castro now, who's shown defensively, so that's more to do offensively. We've had Q, J.R. Tolles didn't really live up to expectations. And before that, we had Brett Ausmus, which is, you know, so basically for the last decade, we've had a defensive first backstop. So it would be really nice if Ben Heath is able to fill out his potential and provide, even if he's not going to, you know, provide a Mark Piazza type of offense, even just some of that would be a godsend compared to what we've seen in the last decade, which is kind of, I guess, why I'm maybe a little more higher on him than somebody else, is because this is something we haven't seen in the Astros system at all in the last decade.
Right.
Well, and I think, like Christian was saying, Mike Napoli is a good comparison, but I think a guy that was in the Astros system in John Buck is also a pretty good comparison. He's shown okay power in his career at the major league level. He doesn't really hit for average, but he's pretty good defensively, too. And, you know, he's serviceable enough to hang around as somebody's second catcher for, so it's 4 or 5 years now, so.
Well, out of a catcher, if Mills is really going to split up the time, I'm not looking for a guy who, based on splits, and is going to have to hit for a high average. I'm looking for a guy who's only going to be playing part-time. If he hits for, you know, an average that's over 250, but still provides plus power, I'm okay with that because he's just a part-time player, and he could possibly really provide that.
And if we do end up keeping both Castro and Heath, I was not really envisioning a straight platoon so much as the same thing we've seen with Castro and Quintero, where they basically get half and half of the playing time, and Heath would get starts against right-handers. So that was sort of what I was envisioning.
Well, I know you guys have said before that Jason Castro has a high floor, low ceiling. So, I guess, kind of, what do you guys see out of Heath as far as a ceiling and a floor?
Well, his ceiling isn't necessarily real high because he has defensive limits as far as, like, how he is as far as a catcher. And the thing is that's a defensive first position where you really look for a defensive, you know, minded person. But because he does provide power, and maybe if he can limit that hitch, he can provide, you know, a higher batting average. Not going to be a .380 batting average, but maybe .280, and provide power. You're talking about a guy who's going to hit closer to the middle of the order. And, I mean, that's a pretty high ceiling when you don't factor in his defensive limitations.
And we're talking about a guy who, by the way, is pretty patient. We saw in his college numbers, and we've seen it this year. So he has an idea of what he's going to do at the plate. And his strikeout numbers aren't that bad. The worry is that it's because he's beating up on lower-level pitching. If his strikeout numbers rise and they're like 25% at Double A, then we might start to get a little bit concerned about his batting average. But it's quite possible that a guy like him, who makes a lot of solid contact, and he has good pitch recognition, as we can see by his walk rate, may actually hit for a decent average, so I don't want to rule that out. But at the same time, he could bust entirely if higher-level pitchers find holes in his swing and he cannot adjust.
Being that, you know, we're still talking about a guy who's in his first short season of professional baseball, he's got a lot of time to make adjustments, so, I mean, I'm not going to put it past him to make an adjustment where he can limit those strikeouts. So, I mean, he's definitely still capable of a whole lot of adjustments and a whole lot of change in his swing right now.
Well, I think getting drafted this year and being so high on the list kind of says something about him. And being the fifth rounder, a fifth round selection, kind of says something.
And really, as far as offensive performance, he could have been drafted a whole lot earlier. But because of his, you know, what scouts call his limitations, kind of puts him down because a lot of people don't think he can stick a catcher. But I think he can if he can, you know, continue to develop. And he's a little bit raw right now, so he could.
Okay, so let's move on to the final first-round pick that we haven't talked about. Mike Wasnicka. We've got some interesting swings on grades here. I think I have him highest. I've got him as a 5, which is a B-minus guy. And Tim, you've got him as a 3, which I'm pretty sure is based on his performance, which has not been really impressive so far for Tri-City.
Yeah, he has not impressed me at all. I mean, you guys must have some magical projection or something for him, but I don't see it. Maybe being the major league guy, I don't know.
Well, here's the thing with Wasnicka. I'm not a big fan, but he's not nearly as bad as he's been this season. Because for one thing, he was dealing with an injury to his hand at one point in the season, and that maybe had inhibited him a little bit, but also, and you don't want to put too much stock into this, but we talked before about the batting average on balls in play. The swing between him having a .266 batting average on balls in play and the lower minors with that defense and having a 26% line drive rate, and again, you have to take that with a grain of salt, but still, it's something. I don't think he's going to hit for that low of a batting average. That's affecting all of his numbers straight down the line.
That's actually, I haven't even noticed that. That is actually really, it's not alarming, but surprising. You would definitely expect a lot higher batting average ball in play with a line drive rate that high, even if it is, you know, inaccurate by any means, but still, it's definitely surprising.
Well, I think also my numeric was kind of based on the fact that he's 21 playing that lower A ball, and he's put up these kind of numbers. I mean, you know, batting average and balls and plays aside, it's these guys should be creating their own luck and finding the holes. You know, in 66 games, he's hit 5 home runs and 10 doubles, and the rest have been, you know, he's got 59 hits, you know. So I mean, a lot of it just seems like single, and it doesn't seem like a whole lot of extra base power to me.
Yeah, that's the thing. The Astros want him to be third baseman, and I'm just not convinced for me that he has the power for the position. And I'm not a huge fan of him as a result. I don't think he's nearly as bad as he's shown, but I'm not sure that he has the ceiling to be more than a little bit above average of the regular.
Well, and he's played, from what I'm seeing here, he's played a little right field, a little DH, and, I mean, he played some catcher in college, too, but, I mean, he's got to be a pretty good defensive catcher to actually be posting those numbers. So if he's playing third base full-time, those numbers do not impress me at all.
I wasn't a fan of the pick, personally. I've grown on the pick, just from, like, reading some Sky reports and his athleticism. And his ability average hitting. Obviously, he hasn't shown it, like Christian said, that he's a better hitter than what he's showing. But I'm with you, Timmy, that I'm not real high on him because he hasn't shown a whole lot, and I'm not sold on him as a third baseman just because his hitting ability it isn't living up to what a third baseman should. Even as a catcher, he isn't living up to it either. But personally, I think you could hit enough to be a catcher. But I'm not high on it.
Again, thanks TCB for listening. We'll hit you tomorrow with the conclusion of our podcast featuring that much anticipated Austin Waite's Twitter fight story that he and I got into. So thanks for listening and come back soon.